So another special guest today, definitely another one of my favorite special guests. Would you like to introduce yourself, special guest?
Thank you very much, special editor. So my name's now Catherine Edgeworth. For many years I was Catherine McKenzie in the NHS, but I was so sad when I retired that I decided it was time to change names. Plus I'd been married for about 25 years, so I thought we were safe.
Very good. So what's your background then, Cathy? Where have you come from?
My background is clinical pharmacy. I worked for 26 years in critical care. I was made a consultant pharmacist in 2006. Always been passionate about medicines, you know, and where the gaps are. My big interest at that time was sedation, actually, and pharmacokinetics. What I couldn't work out was that you felt drugs were safe and then you gave them to patients and they didn't wake up. This was midazolam particularly. And that formed the basis for my PhD. I don't know whether it's direct. I don't know whether it's, what's the word, chasing the boundaries. I just always think if you don't ask, you don't get. So I got one of the first pharmacy grants from the Guy's and Thomas's trustee to do my PhD. And I did it on midazolam and midazolam pharmacokinetics and critical illness. I continued it through my three children. The third was a bit of a surprise. And actually, I did my final viva when I was 37 weeks pregnant. But I got a lot of support from critical care and pharmacy. And so after that, I really tried to build up a sort of practice like a medical consultant, Jonathan. Okay. And they go down different routes, you know, they have their speciality. So my speciality was critical care. I was either going to be an academic that did education, and I did some of that, but my real passion was research, I guess. I just couldn't see any reasons why pharmacists couldn't be leaders in published, you know, clinical studies in their area.
Yeah, so like influencing at the more at the population level, is that what you're after?
Yes, absolutely right. Just and actually just, you know, for example, if one was in general practice, you know, you might ask something like, is there an increase in risk in arrhythmias with clarithromycin therapy over 10 years? And then actually going back and doing data tronching, you know, and having a look. In fact, we did quite a few publications like that, where we showed, you know, for example, the importance of medicines reconciliation, sedation practice. But in terms of critical care, my big focus was either pharmacokinetics, so the alteration in drug handling, or in sedation, and the new phenomenon then in critical care, which was delirium. The reason I was really interested in delirium was, Jonathan, I saw the madness. In fact, I once got delirium. And I saw
Oh, really? God.
Yeah, that's what, you know, ironic, isn't it? I saw how frightened patients were, and I saw how, you know, at least three times the length of stay, long-term problems in cognitive outcomes, big risk, big relationship between delirium and later dementia. And so I've always been interested, if you could alter the course of the delirium in critical care or in the hospital. So you get some trigger, might be an operation, might be sepsis, might be, you know, some complication, and then you get delirium. And then does that then increase your, shorten the time until you get dementia? Yeah.
Okay.
So if you can reduce the delirium, and that's actually a piece of work that I've been really passionate about.
You must have been one of the first consultant pharmacists, am I right? I think it was around 2005, is that right?
So the first was my colleague and friend, Mark Tomlin, who was the first at Southampton.
Okay.
I was really lucky when I came back from my maternity, after having my third child, Tony West, who was the chief pharmacist and great friend, supporter, said, go and find out about transitional arrangements. I didn't know quite what he meant, but this was a traditional arrangement from senior pharmacists going into consultant posts. And he very much supported and drove myself and Steve Tomlin, mm-hmm. who's now the chief pharmacist at Great Ormond Street. He's another great friend to be consultant pharmacist. And then I've always continued this, you know, don't ask, don't get. And I was lucky that quite soon after I got my consultant post, the NIHR at Guy's and Thomas's offered PAs for, it was really for medical consultants, PAs being, you know, the consultant contract with the PA system, Jonathan.
Okay.
Where a PA is one session of time. So an afternoon or a morning, there's 10 sessions in a week. And they were offering funded PAs for consultants to do research. So I thought, well, myself and others said, well, why can't the pharmacists apply? And actually, the hospital were very facilitative. And I got a PA funded, got two PAs, one from the pharmacy and one to do research from the NIHR. And I got that continued all the way up until my retirement, actually. So I was very lucky. The other thing was I learned soon about this thing called the portfolio of studies. So where consultants, medics do clinical research, yeah, they get studies then adopted onto the central portfolio, and where they can apply for additional funding for nurses and things and other support costs. And I think actually pharmacists, for whatever reason, weren't really as knowledgeable about the NIHR when it was first created as they could have been. And I've always been, you know, why are you not doing, why are more pharmacists not applying to the portfolio? I don't believe there are that many on it yet to get funded research. And actually, because I did this, I represent the profession on the critical care portfolio, you know, the critical care sinister specialist group. So that's great. And I continued doing that post-retirement. One of the reasons I retired, one of the main reasons, was I stopped feeling safe. And that's a very funny feeling for a pharmacist.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I got on my prescribing check, but I still was like, well, what if, you know, because I was taking quite a lot of pain medication. I mean, still all cleared by occupational health, but I just didn't feel safe anymore.
No, it's definitely time to go if that's the case. No. So, yeah, I'm interested about the consultant pharmacist piece. And you've obviously gone through that process.
Yeah.
And so my view on the profession at the moment is, perhaps this is naive, but my feeling is we're actually quite a young profession in the modern sort of manifestation of things. And there've been all these titles kind of thrown around, and there's things like, you know, like clinical pharmacist, consultant pharmacist. And I was speaking to someone recently, and I was quite surprised to realize that some of the multiple pharmacies had just invented the term consultant pharmacist.
Yes.
That is true. And I was speaking to another person who said they became a consultant pharmacist within 18 months of being qualified. Now, have you got a view on all that? I mean, I just think it's a bit like the Wild West, to be honest. And
yeah, I mean, it's supposed to be a protected title, and each job is supposed to be accredited by the local CCG. I'm quite passionate that that pharmacy should never go the same way as nursing went, where they are senior clinical leaders. Many of them left clinical roles, and that was why the consultant nurse first came out. I think pharmacists have done better in that they stay in clinical practice on the whole. But I think areas of the UK, for example, Scotland, have not done that perhaps as much. And I think the thing about the consultant pharmacist, if it's used properly, it keeps clinical pharmacists in patient-facing roles. But I think that it is used a little bit, what's the word, too variably. That said, I think some of the very senior community pharmacists who've done their job for 20, 30 years are definitely, you know, consultant community pharmacists. I think some of them lack the confidence that they should have.
Yeah.
To stand up for the patients and their medicines, and to stand up for the pressure that they're under.
Yeah, true. No, I know there's a lot within that, but there's a lot within this area. I mean, there's a lot of titles that aren't actually protected. Like the other one was professor. It's not a protected title.
No.
So no. I just think, I don't know if we've like over pharmacy-ized this problem. To me, it's very, very, like, in my sort of straightforward mind, common sense, it would seem to be quite a straightforward problem that we basically need pharmacists to have a predetermined sort of generic structured career path.
Absolutely.
A bit like medics, right?
Yeah.
Linked to any commercial sort of gain. You shouldn't have to pay for it per se. It should just be the norm that, you know, when you qualify, you do whatever the equivalent is of foundation, and then you move on. And then, you know, if you choose to stay at foundation, well, that's your prerogative. But
yeah,
if not, then you can progress right to consultant. But to be honest, it just seems completely daft that people just call themselves consultant pharmacists. I think it's disingenuous and borderline dishonest, actually.
Well, I do think it's dishonest. I do think it's borderline dishonest. I think we've come some way in the foundation training, haven't we, in hospital pharmacy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but not enough. You know, you're absolutely right. There's not a structured career path. I think even when the consultant pharmacists came out, there's still not enough succession planning.
No.
So, for example, at Guy's and Thomas's, when I was there, you know, I was a consultant, and there was always an idea that a colleague of mine would be the second one. In fact, she is a consultant pharmacist, which is fantastic. But there was still this idea that there's one consultant pharmacist, whereas every medic who stays, even if they stay as a GP, they'd be eventually, you know, they get their accreditation, the Royal College of GPs, and then eventually they become a partner. And unless you decide not to become a partner, that's your role. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So in hospital pharmacy, every senior pharmacist should have a consultant role waiting for them to stay, so they can stay in clinical practice. And I don't know if you've read Lord Carter's report, but that was very much what he said, you know. And I really think pharmacy missed a trick there.
Yeah. Well,
so
listen,
they did all the STPs and all the rest, but one of his real messages were pharmacists are clinical, patient-facing roles. And when they do this, they do that right. And then we should have considered, as a profession, said, yeah, well, we want a consultant then for each pharmacist. And the medics and things wouldn't be against us. They've never been against us, you know. They've never been. I think they see everything as an addition, you know. There might be some of the old school that feel a bit challenged, but actually, I found more challenges in GP practice because they're just not quite as used to it as hospital trainees now that grow up with clinical pharmacists.
Yeah, well, I think my experience in general practice is probably, I don't know, but it's possibly atypical in that it's been absolutely excellent. You know,
I do really.
Yeah, I mean, just pushing me along, scheduled training. I mean, it's straight out of the top drawer. I mean, I'm not just saying that. The evidence kind of backs that up. You know, if
no,
it's super...
do you know what I mean? I completely understand what you mean. In fact, one of my things at the moment is, do I go into general practice? Because I really miss patients. I think there's something really, there's a real pleasure in giving, to be honest. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And a pleasure in giving to little old ladies. I was always like, you know, very passionate about pharmacists going up and holding patients' hands, because, you know, if you sit in an ICU in a ventilator all day, it's pretty dull and boring when you're recovering. So the more people that talk to you, the better. And I think that in general practice must be amazing. I'd love to do that.
Yeah, the thing about general working in GP for me has been, I've only been there a year and a half, but so I was in community for 8 years, and I would say my professional development trajectory was quite steep for about the first 3 years.
In community.
Yeah. As you learn how to be a community pharmacist, and then it really plateaus. However, moving into general practice, and as I say, I must caveat this by saying the practice I work in is a training practice, so they're used to having trainees coming through. The depth of professional development opportunities that they just take for granted is just quite staggering, and pharmacy could really learn a thing or two. And that leads me back to the conversation about consultant, because it actually annoys me if people claim to be something they're maybe not.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to prove it. And also, some of these job roles are linked to organisations as well. So you know, for me, I'm now that I'm in a role that is sort of adding depth to my professional journey, I see little or no support or structured kind of guidance in terms of where I should go. Not completely true. There's a portfolio that's been developed in Scotland for my cohort of pharmacists, but you know, I think by their own admission, it's early days. So yes, anyway, that's my.
Jonathan, have you ever asked your GP practice whether you could eventually become a partner?
I haven't been so forward, but I don't think I'm anywhere
is
near
that.
That
too forward, because I did ask one person that I was actually interested in the job. They didn't really like that question, but why not? I
mean, yeah. Well, why not? Why not exactly?
Perhaps it's being a bit forward.
I don't know. I've never been asked, so it's an interesting one.
I must admit, I've never found any of the juniors that haven't wanted to push themselves forward and do more professional development if they get the opportunity in pharmacy. And the pharmacists are scientists, you know, and they're taught analytical skills, which are really quite important.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of me, one of my aims was to get the whole team at least one peer-reviewed publication, because once you publish... I mean, you know this from your own work, Jonathan, is that to publish a paper, you know, the introduction is the review of all the literature. So just doing the paper, you're suddenly up to date. Yeah. Then you go through the rigor of the methods analysis, and then you get to comment on your results. And it's so rewarding, because suddenly you're in an area. I was like that with my Dazzle, I'm a PhD. I knew more about it than anyone. So often in pharmacy, at that point, you're helping other people make decisions. But with the sedation and stuff, I felt like I knew as much as any of them. And I was always respected in that way, because I'd done my homework. Do you know what I mean?
Great feeling.
It is a good feeling. And it's a good feeling that we should all aspire to. I mean, actually, I've seen a lot, which should be really rewarding and challenging from the other side, Jonathan, from the CRPS charity, in that I see persons with CRPS just desperate for information on their medicines, just you know, desperate for medicines optimization. They just don't get, because the GPs haven't got time. I don't blame anyone, it's just the system. And of course, if someone presents in front of you and says, I've got pain, I mean, you probably see it from your own GP practice. Do you see chronic pain patients?
Yeah, quite frequently, actually. Yeah.
And so do you titrate the medicines, so that you probably do, to get the most out of them?
I'm most interested in bringing folk off tramadol where appropriate, but yes, I've titrated up and down as well in my
prescription. Well, actually, interesting, the RCRPS UK conference, I take the slant that if you tell persons that something is bad for them, it's not tramadol particularly, it's the stronger opioids first, I think. Having been on them myself, my pain was really bad. I thought then I was going demented. I really did. And if you tell patients, or persons, I'm supposed to call them, that taking these medicines long term will be bad for you, rather than sort of phrasing it as, I'm not going to give you your pain medicines anymore because you've become addicted to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actually, the person with CRPS didn't come in and say, can I get a prescription for morphine? Because I wanted people to come, you know, it was given to them because they were in pain. But if you said to them, actually, long term, these are going to be really bad for you, I think you should consider reducing, got much more better reception. It's interesting, isn't it?
Very interesting. So on that note, go tell us what is CRPS and what's
your... So complex regional pain syndrome is a syndrome in the brain. I've got a bad brain. So it's an abnormal sympathetic response really to an injury, usually to an injury, but not always.
Okay.
So I had a ski injury where I ruptured my ACL, my cruciate ligament, was in the middle of my knee. And from about day three, the pain far outweighed the injury. And I'd go along to the physio classes and I'd say, I'm in pain. And they'd say, there's nothing we can do. And then I was very lucky, at 6 months, I just collapsed in pain, and my orthopaedic surgeon, Adil Adjuid, who's a gorgeous man, I've told you this in my story, so I don't want to go on about it. Essentially, diagnosed complex regional pain syndrome, referred me to Tom Smith, who's my wonderful pain consultant. He's done everything for me possible, I have to say. But I was really lucky because the pain is unbearable. And if you're a health professional, you can do a bit of reading. And I knew the most important thing was to keep moving, even at times where I really felt like giving up. And I do have a wheelchair for when I need it. But if you're not educated, what you do is you stop losing. If something really hurts, you stop using it, don't you? You know, you just can't bear to stand on it. And so long-term complex regional pain syndrome is a major cause of disability in the UK.
Okay.
What happens is persons will stop using their limb because it becomes very painful. They also get this syndrome called allodynia, where so normally if you touch something, it won't be painful, but you have this extreme response to pain. It's one of the discerning criteria, is the abnormal, you know, touching it. Mine was really bad, like a tablecloth touching my knee. I'd get dreadful sympathetic guarding when I jump, and it would be really excruciatingly sore. So it's allodynia, change in temperature, your limb becomes very cold, change in colour. That was the one thing I noticed, actually. I knew something was wrong, was when my legs started to go blue. And you sort of get this rejection to the limb that is more than just, well, that hurts. It's, I can't bear this. I knew I had to keep on touching it, but those less health educated, let's see, it's not less educated, less health, they don't realise that. And so they stop touching the limb. It then becomes more dysmorphic. I almost think the body rejects it, becomes very swollen. And the longer you don't touch it, or you don't move it, Jonathan, more painful it gets.
Okay.
So persons with CRPS can, chronic CRPS can live with pain, disability, you know, loss of job, loss of income, depression, very severe depression, and loneliness, actually.
In fact, loneliness. And are you involved? You're involved in a charity?
Yes, that was one of the things I said when I retired, was I'd like to do some work with the charity. And I contacted CRPS UK charity, and I now work with some really fantastic girls. The project is Living with CRPS. It's in terms of health, wealth and disability. Health, we're using quite a number of validated questionnaires, including quality of life, is it SF36 or something, HADS, the depression scale. And I actually, one area that I'm really interested in is which analgesic, which painkiller do persons with CRPS think is the most effective? That'd be really interesting, wouldn't it?
I think you come at it with tremendous credibility as a, you know, as a pharmacist and as a patient, to be honest.
Yeah. So
quite a unique insight there, really, actually.
Yes. Well, thank you. I mean, I'm lucky that I got NHS ill health retirement. Other people are living lives of destitute. In fact, I think I feel really passionately that people, I wish I'd had more advice this time to not give up. You know, don't give up. Just keep on going. Mm-hmm. Because once you stop going, you become a person living at home with pain. It's not a great life, really, is it?
No, I can imagine it's horrible.
And actually, because the pain's in the sympathetic nervous system, in fact, I learned this a lot when I retired, is that if you down-regulate, yeah, so if you reduce stressful environments, so for example, like me, like critical care, you use techniques like mindfulness, it won't get rid of the pain, but it down-regulates your sympathetic system to help you manage it. Yeah? So there's lots of different strategies.
Aesthetics, Cathy.
Yeah.
Now, this is, let me sort of give you my take on it.
Yeah.
I don't really have an opinion on it, actually, because I've never been involved. I don't feel like I can have an opinion because I haven't actually practiced it. I've had no training in it. However, what I'm hearing is there's quite a mixed sort of opinion across the piece on pharmacists doing aesthetics.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. In
fact, would that be fair to say?
Yes. In fact, I think there is quite a mixed opinion, and actually I can understand where the mixed opinion comes from. I've always been passionate, actually, pharmacists should be able to do the journey from the start to the finish. So you can't just prescribe a medicine or dispense it. You know, I've always thought you should know how to reconstitute it and you should know how to inject it. Do you do subcut injections at the moment, Jonathan?
No, not at the minute, but no, I totally agree with you. I mean, I'm, you know, don't take my kind of balanced.
You question. don't sound, and I hope I didn't sound.
No, not at all.
Combative.
No, not at all. Don't take my balanced kind of questioning on this subject as an opinion, as it were. I'm all for pharmacists doing more and more and more. And if you know, if properly regulated medical practitioners are doing this, well, why can't pharmacists do it? And arguably. Absolutely. Arguably, there's a really good business case and a potential good news story for community pharmacists doing this in tough times. However, let me paint a picture. You know, we are living in the millennial Instagram, Facebook generation. Yes. Looks matter. There's an increase in anabolic steroid use. The young fellas and lassies are bulking up and toning up, and what they look like matters. So, I mean, I guess the cynic in me would say, you know, stick up a few Instagram posts about, you know, airbrushed and come and get a few fillers. You know, I think that's it's about doing it right, isn't it? Really,
I absolutely agree. And actually, that's one of the things that perhaps. Why my practice has not grown as quickly as I want, because I don't like posting before and after pictures. I don't think it's about that. I think it's for I guess one, you know, for me, many of my clients would be ladies about my age or younger, you know, 40 plus, who might be menopausal, might not be, but actually they just want a bit of a confidence boost. Their children might have grown up, they might have a bit of disposable income. I don't, but they might have. And, you know, it's the same cost as buying a new dress, provided it's done by a registered health professional who can prescribe. Now, I feel quite strongly that pharmacists can legally inject. I don't think pharmacists should do aesthetics if they can't prescribe. And that is because I think the prescribing course is an additional learning skill. Do you know what I mean? In terms of, you do get additional clinical assessments on it.
I actually didn't know that folk could do aesthetics without being a prescriber.
Yeah, you can do, so you can inject. It's amazing, isn't it? The industry is not regulated.
Goodness.
Possibly because of Brexit. I knew I'd bring that up. I think there was a report by Bruce Keogh a couple of years ago said it should be better regulated, but one has to be a prescriber to prescribe botulinum toxin, Botox. One doesn't have to be a prescriber to prescribe dermal fillers, but you do have to be a prescriber to prescribe so if you hit an artery with a dermal filler, you need to give, there's an antidote, hyaluronidase. And to give that, to prescribe that, you need to be a prescriber. To prescribe something for a rest situation, you need to be a prescriber. The reason I think pharmacists should do it, Jonathan, is I think the prescribing course is 2 years after qualification, isn't it?
At least.
And while I did it, so I did supplementary, then I did the conversion. I found the stuff, the ethics stuff, very helpful. And the additional clinical assessment skills. And I think to do aesthetics, I think pharmacists, so if they don't have those skills as undergraduates, they don't get them. I think prescribing gives them it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally, totally.
Yeah. So no, they don't have to, but the thing is, there's been a bit of a fight back from the medics, the dentists and the nurses, not all of them, it has to be said, but some of them saying that, you know, you have to be a medic, dentist or a nurse to be in aesthetics. Now, they can't stop pharmacists doing it. Particularly independent prescribing pharmacists who can prescribe Botox as well and administer it. But the problem is a lot of the high quality training at a reasonable price is provided at conferences where pharmacists, registered pharmacists, are not allowed to enter some of the training things because they don't have a GMC, GDC, G, whatever, G What's the nursing one? NMC registration, which is a shame. I think it's tempered with Jonathan. It's a dog-eat-dog industry. It's cosmetics, you know?
Yeah, highly competitive, I guess.
Highly competitive. So I'd stick at the moment to doing friends and family that personally approach me. And I enjoy that at home. It's a new skill. I keep up to date. I do a lot of CPD online on it, actually. If I could spend my spare time better, it would be to get pharmacists accredited to do private patient, you know. But I mean, because I'm a doctor, because I have the title doctor, it's maybe not as obvious, but I always say I'm a pharmacist. I'm really proud of my profession. So it's a bit of a challenge. I have to say the RPS, which I'm a huge fan of, because I'll just have put a plug in for them, because they've been very supportive to me. And it is our only national leadership body. And like it or loathe it, you've got to be part of it. That's my view.
Cool.
You won't have influence. Anyway, but they've been very good. And they've signed a memorandum of understanding with one of the regulating registers. It just becomes really expensive, to be honest, the whole thing, unless you're doing it full time. And I'm not going to do that. But I still keep my hand in, you know?
Yeah, no, that's great. But listen, it's been great speaking to you, Cathy, and very interesting career. You've done so much, from academia to, you know, consult pharmacists.
I'm going to continue. I've got two other studies. I've got a gent study. In fact, I'm going to see Pharmacy Research UK about, and another study which I'll tell you about next time, which is a big exciting one. Jonathan, it's lovely to chat to you as well.
You too. See you next time. I'll hold you to that. All right. See you. Bye.
Bye.